I'm Gabe Ortiz, afternoon host at WIPR. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make the live streams like this one more difficult to maintain. Stand up for public media and help fortify WIPR's future. Find out more and donate at WIPR.org. Thank you.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today. It's another edition of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. Monica's a licensed nutritionist and the host of the popular Nutrition Diva podcast, where she explores the latest food and nutrition research, headlines, and trends. She presents at food and nutrition conferences around the country, and she works with international organizations on health and wellness issues. We're also joined today by Ted Kyle, a healthcare professional and advocate who works to advance changes in policy and public opinion. In addition to his work in obesity, Ted has worked on tobacco dependence, HIV, infectious diseases, and other diverse health issues. His organization, Conscious Health, seeks to advance evidence-based approaches to health and obesity. More than 40% of American adults are obese, and in a recent essay in the New York Times, former FDA director Dr. David Kessler wrote about the important role that GLP-1 medications can play in helping us reduce our caloric intake and shed those unwanted pounds. But GLP-1 drugs come with some downside, too, and if we rely on them too much, we may lose sight of the numerous other factors that affect how much and what we eat. Monica Reinagle and Ted Kyle join me on Zoom. Monica, welcome. Always a pleasure.
Hi, Tom.
And Ted, good to have you back as well. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, you are welcome to be part of our conversation. Very interested in particular to hear from folks who are taking the GLP-1 medications. These are drugs like Mogovi and Ozempic, etc. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. So, Monica, let me start with you. David Kessler is a former head of the FDA. He's run a couple of medical schools. He writes about his personal experience with weight loss, in which he's had really dramatic shifts in his weight from obese to very, very thin. I mean, he's lost, lots and lots of weight at various times, and sometimes he's gained it back. But he talks about addictive junk foods. And he says that this was certainly a big driver of his own struggle with compulsive eating, and that it's a driver of the obesity epidemic in America. I mean, can we really, Monica, be addicted to food the way we're addicted to heroin or nicotine or stuff like that?
That is a controversial question, Tom. And I think many people listening might identify with this sense of being unable to control ourselves around certain foods or in certain environments. And that may feel like it's overpowering in the way an addiction might be. And there is some research, a lot of animal studies that show that certain foods, in particular these ones that Dr. Kessler is worried about, do kind of light up some of the same areas of the brain that respond when we expose those animals to, say, heroin or cocaine. So there does seem to be a relationship there, but I think it goes too far, really, to put food in the same category as an addictive chemical like heroin and cocaine, both in terms of the science, but also in terms of how we respond to it.
And is it just junk food? I mean, Dr. Kessler, in his essay in the New York Times, talks about junk food in particular. Is it junk food, or are there other foods that might not be considered, generally speaking, terrible for you, but are addictive in the way that Kessler is at least referring to it.
Well, food, we find food pleasurable, all different kinds of food. You know, just a perfectly ripe tomato or a strawberry can also be very pleasurable. And so our brains will respond to those. So it may be a matter of degree, you know, just how strong that response is. But Kessler really sets his sights. I had a chance to speak with him last week in relationship to the new book that he's just published. And he's really focused on foods that combine what he considers to be the sort of evil trifecta of sugar, salt, and fat. Those are three nutrients that you don't see combined in foods in nature. We do that. We layer them together. And he feels that that particular combination of flavors and sensations is so compelling to the brain that it really does override our body's signals to say, for example, oh, I'm full now. I've had enough. Let me stop eating. And moreover, he feels that food manufacturers know this and have deliberately manipulated the food supply, snack foods and those kinds of things, to push that button and to really get us hooked on these foods that we can't stop eating. That works out well for the food manufacturers as a business model, but Kessler feels like it's had a lot of negative impacts on public health and his own health.
And Monica, I mean, as a nutritionist, do you think it's a good idea to frame food as an addictive possibility, at least? Is there an upside, a downside? How do you see it?
I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, unlike cocaine or heroin or nicotine, we have to eat. And so we don't want to demonize food as a harmful substance. I think that sets up some very dysfunctional thinking about food. And can sometimes, when people adopt this label, oh, I'm a food addict, it can drive them to some very extreme, restrictive, and ultimately unhealthy behaviors. But on the other hand, this recognition that certain foods really do tend to override our better judgment can help people feel a little bit less shame about the fact that they may have struggled to control their intake of foods, that you know, they don't seem to have enough willpower, they can't exercise moderation. This concept that some foods are really manipulating their brain responses can maybe help them feel a little bit less blame and shame about struggling with this.
And Ted Kyle, when David Kessler was the FDA commissioner, he was a driving force behind getting nicotine to be known as addictive, and that helped pave the way for aggressive regulation of tobacco. He now talks about a parallel between tobacco or nicotine and ultra-formulated food. So is that, in your view, a reasonable parallel? I mean, does that make sense to you?
It's a really compelling metaphor, isn't it? A lot of people have trouble with moderate consumption of these so-called junk foods or ultra-formulated foods. But the truth is that food is a lot more complex than nicotine or a cigarette. And so what I would say is that this idea of addictive foods is more of a metaphor than it is a representation of science. The science is much more complicated.
You've written that every complex problem has a solution that is simple, plausible, and wrong. which is terrific formulation. There are obviously, in terms of public policy, some serious implications of trying to, I don't know, put labels on junk food. I mean, they've already done that a little bit. There are restaurants where most restaurants now, you have to go in and they'll have to tell you how many calories are in whatever you're ordering. What in your view, are the policy implications of trying to label or regulate so-called junk food?
I think it's quite a challenge, because we know that these ultra-processed foods Can be problematic. We know that from a whole lot of research, and most of all, some research that was done at the NIH by Kevin Hall, who is unfortunately no longer there. And when he left NIH, one of the sticking points that led him to leave was the fact that the new leadership of the NIH really liked this metaphor of addictive ultra-processed foods. And he was hesitant to alter his scientific research to say, this is an addiction problem. What he would tell you is that we really have a lot more to learn about ultra-processed foods, and he's one of the smartest guys I know when it comes to the subject of ultra-processed foods.
That's Ted Kyle. He's a healthcare professional and an advocate with Conscient Health. Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. She's the host of the popular Nutrition Diva podcast and a good friend of our show who comes on for our Smart Nutrition segments. We'd love to hear from you. 410-662-8780 or email midday@wipr.org. So, Monica, when you talk about salt, sugar, and fat, there are nights at our house where we call that dinner, and Ted, we've been all talking about this morning. Ted, you and I have talking about ultra processed foods, and David Kessler in this piece in the Times talks about ultra formulated foods. He makes a distinction. What, in your view, is that distinction, and is that an important one?
I really appreciate this distinction between ultra-processed and ultra-formulated. As Ted just pointed out, we've had a lot of conversation and a lot of research on ultra-processed foods over the last few years. And that term is based on a classification system. I think we've talked about it on Smart Nutrition in the past, called the NOVA system, which categorizes foods according to the degree of processing they have undergone. Now, Kevin Hall is undoubtedly one of the smartest people about ultra-processed foods, but another real smartie on this topic is Dr. Julie Hess, who works at the USDA. And she has actually done some really interesting research showing that the degree of processing is not always a proxy for the nutritional quality of a food. So in other words, she has demonstrated that you can put together a diet that's made up almost entirely of what would be considered to be ultra-processed foods, which, by the way, might include things like soy milk or plant-based burgers or fortified breakfast cereal. You could put together an ultra-processed diet that's actually significantly healthier and more nutritious than the typical American diet. And the corollary to that, you can create it, you can construct a diet that is minimally processed, nothing out of a package or a bag or a can, and have it fall well short of the nutrition standards. So ultra-processed foods includes a lot of these ultra-formulated foods, but it includes a lot of other things as well. So what Kessler is narrowing the focus here to talk not just about the degree of processing, but the purpose of the processing. So has this food been processed in order to make it to add nutritional value or make it more shelf stable or make it safer, or has been processed to concentrate the salt and the sugar, to make it crispy, to enhance the flavor, to make it irresistible? Those are the foods that he's referring to as ultra-formulated, as distinct from other foods which may be quite processed, but actually could play a really valuable role in a diet because, most of us have jobs and don't have time to, bake every loaf of bread from scratch. So I actually appreciated that distinction.
Yeah, that's interesting. And Ted Kyle, you've written something that originally really surprised me, where you say that most of our food comes in the form of foods that qualify as ultra processed. And I always thought of ultra processed as just being, the Twinkies in the box on that in the shelf, in the aisle where all the junk food is concentrated a lot of times in grocery stores. But I mean, is there a classification system that you can imagine that would, number one, survive industry pushback, and I'm sure there'd be lots of that, and still be beneficial to public health?
Well, that's the billion-dollar question because, in fact, what we found ourselves is with a food supply that has evolved so that it is very convenient, very accessible, and very pleasurable. That whole combination, which actually goes beyond just the substance of the food, the composition of the food, but the whole food environment that we find ourselves in, where these foods are so convenient, that has a lot to do with the patterns of consumption and the idea that 60 to 70% of the American diet is ultra-processed foods comes from research that's been done at Harvard and other institutions looking at just what are people buying and consuming. What I will mention is that the whole idea of making food very appealing is nothing new and not exclusive to the food industry. My spouse makes a wonderful chocolate satin pie, but it's not available every day of the week to me. I do enjoy it, and I try and enjoy it in moderation. There are other foods, the oatmeal that I have for breakfast every day. I get great pleasure out of that, but it's also very nourishing. So this is a really complicated subject where the problems with the food supply have to do both with the substance of the food and how appealing it is, but also how we interact with it and how it appears in our environment and how we go to meetings and feel like in a meeting we can't really survive the meeting if there's not food sitting around the margins of the meeting that we can snack on while we're getting bored with the meeting that we're engaged in.
Ted Kyle is a healthcare professional who's worked for more than 10 years on evidence-based approaches to obesity and health. And Ted, are you able to stick around for a little bit after we take a quick break?
Sure.
That'd be great. And Smart Nutrition will continue with Monica Reinagel. She's the nutrition diva. You can join us at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And before we go to a break, a clarification about one of the issues that I spoke about yesterday in my conversation with Baltimore Police Commissioner Richard Worley. We talked about Attorney General Anthony Brown's years-long investigation into determinations made by former state medical examiner David Fowler, who served in that position for about 17 years before retiring in 2019. An expert panel found that in 36 cases of suspects who died in police custody, Fowler declined to classify those deaths as homicide, which was incorrect. In one of those cases, the death of Tyrone West in 2013, the initial classification was undetermined, and an independent review panel later determined Mr. West's death was, in fact, a homicide. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the show, it's Midday on Pets. Dr. Lisa Garrity of the Greater Annapolis Veterinary Hospital answers your questions about your furry, feathered, or four-legged friends, those dear companions who walk or run or fly or swim or maybe just sleep a lot. You can leave a question on our listener line at 410-735-1616, and you can join me and Dr. Lisa Garrity tomorrow on Midday. Again, the number 410-735-1616. Leave a message with your question for Midday on Pets.
Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say.
And today we're answering questions about a different kind of animal, a species of bipedal mammals called Homo sapiens, us. The nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel, is with us on Zoom for another edition of Smart Nutrition. Ted Kyle of Conscient Health is with us as well. Monica is a licensed nutritionist, health coach, speaker, and wellness program designer, and a great friend of our program. And Ted has been on the show before. He writes about health issues, studies obesity, and other issues. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. So, Monica, the GLP-1s, these, wonder drug anti-obesity drugs, in the context of food addiction, what's your take? Are they treating a real addiction, or are they just I mean, one of the things they do is they suppress your appetite, right? You take those things and then you don't need to eat as much to feel full.
Well, they have a number of effects, and I think we're still in the process of understanding exactly what those effects are. They do act on the digestive system to just slow down the speed at which food is processed, and that means that you don't get as hungry as quickly. But there are also effects in the brain. They have what we are now learning to refer to as food noise, that kind of constant chatter that's going on in our heads, wondering where is my next snack coming from, and you know, the brownies that are calling to me from the cupboard, that they seem to quiet that food noise. And so, you know, that could really feel like relief for people who have felt a compulsive urge to overeat in the past. And that was part of what Dr. Kessler describes experiencing when he himself went on those medications. I think, though, to just boil this down to these drugs are an antidote to food addiction is a gross oversimplification, both of the treatment, but also just of the disease of obesity. And that's something that Ted knows even more about than I do.
Yeah, and Ted, you've written about the fact that there are lots of other reasons besides processed junk food, ultra-processed junk food that can lead to obesity. And part of them include the fact that we eat for and we make food for all sorts of different reasons in different contexts, the ubiquity of its availability for those of us who are lucky enough to not be food insecure. There's a lot that goes into this, right?
There sure is. And in fact, you know, people spend a lot of time thinking about, so why do we have so much obesity now? And what's happened is the environment that we live in has changed dramatically over the last several decades. And it is true that it is our biology that we inherit from our parents that sets us up for obesity, but it's the environment that really serves it up and activates that susceptibility. And that environment is in part the food that is all around us and how it's formulated and how it's presented and how it's available to us, but also the physical environment and the technology that we interact that has us moving less on a routine basis, the economic and social stress that we experience, and then the chemicals and drugs that we are exposed to, sometimes without even intending to, and knowing precisely what is triggering it in every individual is really hard to do. But what these GLP-1s do is that they help correct some of the disorder in the metabolic function of your body that regulates how much you eat and how much weight you add on. And what we've learned from those medicines is that they are regulating signals between your brain and your gut to restore them to a more normal state for so long as you are taking them. And that puts you in a healthier metabolic state.
Yeah, and Ted, you've also, you've written about how much we don't know about the sort of molecular capacity and interaction of food. You say that there's, you quote a couple of researchers who say that there are likely more than 139,000 chemicals in food that modulate a large number of human proteins, but about 2,000 of those food molecules are currently used as drugs. That means there's a whole lot, 137,000 plus, that we don't know what they do. We don't know on that subcellular level what they're capable of. So food is a very complex thing, and there, you know, as much as we do know, there's a whole lot we don't know.
That's exactly right. Food and how your body interacts with it is almost infinitely complex, but we've learned a lot. And we, in the process of learning a lot, we've learned how much we don't know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just, Tom, people may be alarmed by that number, 139,000 chemicals. And I want to just clarify, those are not synthetic chemicals that have been added to the food. That's actually when we take our food and break it down into its molecular components. That's how complex it is.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a lot. And it is complex, and it's part of nature. So, Monica, I mean, in terms of practical steps that folks can take to protect themselves when it comes to this GLP-1 situation. I mean, we've talked about it a couple of times. I've also talked about it with Dr. Nguyen when she comes for the Midday Health Watch. There's an upside and a downside to taking these. There, a lot of people have very bad reactions to taking the GLP-1s. And obviously, the food regulation, whether or not it ever happens, isn't going to happen overnight. What should we be thinking of in general terms to, you know, to stay healthy?
Yeah, we are a long way from enacting Dr. Kessler's vision, where junk foods would have a warning label on the front of the package, the way a cigarette package does, warning you that these foods may be dangerous to your health. And that's, you know, not going to happen anytime soon. But I think that by being aware of the way our bodies respond to these foods that are hyperpalatable and very appealing and deliberately so, but also, to Ted's point, being aware of all of the other factors in our environment, the social cues, the social normalization, the prompting that contribute to overeating, when we are aware of those factors, even if we can't overnight legislate them or regulate them out of effect or medicate them out of our environment, being aware of them does give us a handle on steps that we can take. So just knowing that I am going to have a hard time stopping at just one might, well, it does lead me to keep fewer foods like that in my home so that I don't have to have that argument or that negotiation with myself every night at 8 p.m. If it's not there, then I am less susceptible to it. And just knowing, like, yeah, those are things that I might want to enjoy occasionally, but I certainly don't want to have them always around in unlimited quantities because I know how that's going to go. And to Ted's point about his wife's chocolate silk pie, which I haven't had yet, but I hope to soon, these trigger foods, I'll call them, can just as easily be created in our own kitchen as they can be picked up at the grocery store or increasingly now the hardware store, the car repair shop, the, you know, yeah, everywhere.
Everybody sells food, right?
Right. We can make these foods ourselves and they are just as compelling. And so I think that awareness can help us take steps to put just personal guardrails in place to kind of, you know, help us exercise a little maybe external control, knowing that our internal control may not be infinite around those kinds of foods.
Let's go to the phones. Rosetta is on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to the program with Monica Reineagle and Ted Kyle.
Thank you. I have a sister in Washington, D.C. She's 81 years old, and she used to go to the gym regularly. And after gym, she would stop by a nearby a fast food place and get a snack. She did this on a regular basis to the point where she became addicted to that. And then she would go to Costco, for one thing, and see all these foods around her and buy these large quantities, which Costco's only sell in large quantities, sweets and things that she does not need, bring those home, and she'd be surrounded by those, looking at it all the time, and start eating those sweet foods and snacks that she bought at Costco's. So she became addicted, and now she's scheduled for a triple bypass next Wednesday. She's only 81 years old.
Boy. Well, thank you for sharing that story, Rosetta, and I'm sure that you're not alone, you and your family. And Ted Kyle, you know, given what Rosetta's talking about, what Monica just alluded to when it comes to the social cues for food, the habits we develop for good or for bad, it's very difficult to imagine policy, you know, public policy initiatives that could address those kinds of things. I mean, are there any that strike you as a good? I mean, are warning labels or nutrition labels that we currently have, are they adequate in your estimation? Should they be more detailed? Should they have different information? Just in terms of policy, how should we be slicing this apple?
I will suggest that policy solutions cannot operate in a vacuum. And so you can put all the warning labels in the world that you want on foods, but if you are working within a social environment, an economic environment that is going in a totally different direction, they might have nil effect. And so you really need to align everything. And that's why this is sometimes referred to as a wicked problem, because it exists as part of a complex adaptive systems that interact with each other. Putting warning labels on or labeling menus at fast food restaurants with calories seems to have little long-term effect, because people start filtering it out. When that's all you do, you don't move the needle very much. And I think that the illustration of the Costco food environment is a perfect example, where susceptible individuals are encouraged to buy lots and fill up your home with it and surround yourself with all these cues to eat. That's not the stated intention, but that tends to be the result, and it's not a very helpful one.
Yeah, and Monica, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the new head of the Department of Health and Human Services, refers all the time to the toxic food supply. And he talks about banning additives is a way of reducing addictive foods that can, you know, lead to overconsumption and obesity. Again, as a framing issue, is our food supply toxic? Is that a legitimate characterization?
I don't think it's a very helpful one. I think that there is legitimate criticism of the way different food additives are regulated and policed. You know, basically we have the food industry policing itself, and, you know, it is a for-profit industry. And so there's certainly room there for that policing to be somewhat lax. So I think that it makes sense to look at that framework, but to just categorize every compound in the food supply as harmful, much less addictive, is a way over generalization, and could lead to really unhelpful effects. I think we need to have a much more targeted and intelligent approach to what deserves our attention first, which are the things that are most likely to be problematic, and let's ensure perhaps a different framework for ensuring their safety. But I think it's not helpful or accurate to just characterize the entire food supply as toxic, and to create this mistrust among consumers that if they see something on a label that they can't immediately pronounce, that it's toxic to them. Sometimes that's just the chemical name for a nutrient, a vitamin or something. So I think we need to bring expertise and discernment to whatever attempts we make to evaluate the food supply, and move carefully, move cautiously.
I mean, Ted, is it a matter of education, the way we educated people about the harmful effects of tobacco and its relation to lung cancer? Those ads still appear on television because there's still plenty of people who are smoking, many of whom I'm sure wish they weren't smoking. And you see, some pretty dramatic examples of the deleterious effects of smoking in some of these broadcast ads. We also see, I swear I put on 5 pounds just watching football games, because every commercial, there's a pizza commercial or a burger commercial, and they look incredibly inviting. I don't actually order the pizzas and eat the burgers, but still, just watching it seems to, by osmosis, make me gain weight. Is there an angle towards education, a particular way we should be talking about this to steer people to eating? Who was it? The writer who said you basically eat everything your grandmother used to grow or your grandmother could get, because in her day we didn't have as much processing about foods. How should we be trying to educate people?
The best angle that I can offer would be to point people to nutrition professionals like Monica, who genuinely know what they're talking about, to help people figure out for themselves, because everybody's different, everybody's circumstances are different, figure out for themselves how they can enjoy the pleasure of food in a healthful way. Food is inherently pleasurable. It is different from tobacco and cigarettes, where we were not born to consume nicotine, to smoke it and fill our lungs with it. We were born to eat. And so we have important biological functions that ensure that we do eat and enjoy our food.
Ted Kyle
is... The key is to figure out how to do it.
Right. And thank you, Ted. We are out of time. Ted Kyle's a healthcare professional with Conscient Health. He studies evidence-based approaches to obesity and health. Thank you so much, Ted. Really appreciate it. And Monica Reinagle is a licensed nutritionist and the host of the popular Nutrition Diva podcast, where she explores the latest food and nutrition research, headlines, and trends. Always great to have you for Smart Nutrition. Monica, thanks so much.
Look forward to next time.
All right, me too. Quick break, and when we return, making meals as an act of resistance. The Reverend Derek Weston of Creation Justice Ministries joins me in 90 seconds. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR.